Oh, okay.
Let me check. I have that. No, it's all right. Starting soon. We have that bit.
All right, now we can see ourselves.
Yay!
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, great. Yeah, we're good.
So are we back on?
We're back on.
I see it on the YouTube small site as well. So.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I'm going to restart as if it's new because this is going to be the video. So,
party time!
Welcome to the ASP.NET Core 3.0 Preview 6 release party. This is take two because our first take crashed, but that's fine. It's going to be even better.
We already ate all the cake. It's gone. We don't.
Yeah. So I want to allow you as much time as possible. I'm going to jump right into my community stand-up links, and I'm going to make them super fast, and then we'll jump over to you for the demos and stuff. So can you switch to my screen?
Is that okay?
Yes. Hooray. Okay, cool. I'm just going to rip through them. Shahed, he's doing an A through Z series on ASP.NET Core features. So this is letter X. This is XML and JSON serialization in ASP.NET Core. So here he's showing with an API returning both JSON and XML data. So doing stuff, you know, showing using accept headers, showing different kinds of queries. Here he's working through, you know, searching and all kinds of good stuff. So this is amazing and good job, Shahed. Moving on. This is pretty cool. So Andrew Locke has been doing a series on feature flags with ASP.NET Core 3. This is a new feature. And a neat thing that Andrew is showing here is that feature flags are not just a binary on or off kind of thing. They actually, you can do more complex things. So here he's showing using two that ship with it. One is a time window filter. So here he's saying, for example, only show a banner during Christmas. So this is setting up the thing and saying, you know, this is my time window. So, you know, this is obviously like Christmas, could be done with shopping. You could do something during business hours or during a conference. I've done things where I hard coded stuff during conferences, you know, to turn things on and off. So this is pretty neat. And then he's also showing rolling a feature out using a percentage filter. So again, you know, having a value and kind of rolling it out, you know, here it's at 10%. So that's pretty cool. Two others that I'm just showing, these are the next three are basically long form textual versions of stuff that you folks are going to show. So I'm going to make them even faster. But here Gunnar is showing a feature which is authentication with server-side Blazor applications. So that is pretty neat. Exciting to see that. So here he's walking through, you know, enabling it and then showing the front end user experience.
We'll show this live in just a minute.
Yep. Yeah. Automatic reconnect with Signal R3.0. So Jerry Pelzer walking through that. That is also super cool. And then here's your post. So this is the long form written version of stuff we're showing here. And then there's a decent amount of other features we probably won't be able to get to today, right?
We'll just do the highlight reel, but if you want the full story, go read the blog post.
And as always, I'll share these links in the show notes, and we'll tweet them out, and we'll put them on the Twitters and in the chat on both Twitch and all the stuff, Twitch and YouTube. All right, so I'm going to pass it back over to you, and there we go.
All right, should we show some features?
We should show some features. Yes, and as part of this, we also need to introduce. So, Dan, you've been on 1,000 times. Sarab, you've been on a few times, so that is cool. And then Stefan has never been on the ASP.NET community stand-up.
He's new.
He's new, exciting.
We have to initiate him into the guild of live community stand-up participants.
Right, yep. Yeah. I thought this was an exclusive club for PMs. It's supposed to be Brady here instead of me. I was just told yesterday that I was filling the slot.
We let the occasional dev come on board.
After 6 years that you're finally allowed? Is that how it works?
Yeah. We'll get you back in another 6 years.
All right, perfect. All right, so everybody, I'm here to talk to you about SignalR's new auto reconnect feature, which was introduced to the JavaScript and TypeScript client. It's definitely there in Preview 6. It's also there in other previews, but we really have documentation for it and want to get people trying it in these early previews to have people try it out. So if any of you are interested in learning about SignalR Core, new SignalR features, I recommend you check out the samples at github.com/SignalR. Brady, when he told me so that I was going to be speaking at this community stand-up, suggested that I just use his demo with automatic reconnect sample, which is really great. It actually has a great README with screenshots. But I feel that most of the people watching the community stand-up might have seen some of this content. So I am going to go through taking another sample that you might already know and love called StreamR. You might have seen it. I'm going to run it.
StreamR.
It was created by a co-worker, Brendan Conroy. He also did the streaming feature for SignalR that enabled this whole thing. So please check it out, even if you're not super interested in the auto reconnect stuff. But what this looks like is, let's watch the stream.
Do you mind getting closer to the mic?
Yeah, sorry guys.
Lean in. Right. Get closer.
Yes. All right. So this is it. But the problem is as soon as we lose a connection with SignalR Core, the stream closes. We don't continue. And unless you manually wrote a closed event handler in your client code to restart a client after a certain amount of time or whatever, or you tell your customers just to refresh the web page, you're not going to get this video stream back. So we can look at the source code for StreamR, and this is our index.cshtml, and what you might recognize is this hub connection builder. If you've ever worked with the web host builder, right, it's a very similar pattern. So this is how you create your hub connection in SignalR. You can set up your URL and endpoint. And for 3.0, we added this new API called with automatic reconnect. And I've written this about 5,000 times in the last month, so I'm sure I spelled it wrong. So what this will do is now that we've done with automatic reconnect, instead of firing the onClose callback as soon as we lose the underlying TCP connection, we're going to start trying to reconnect. And we added two new callbacks, reconnect on reconnecting and on reconnected. And we'll demonstrate really quickly how that can look. But let's first restart our app with just plain old default with automatic reconnect and see if that just like fixes the StreamR example. Right.
I'm gonna nag you to get closer to the mic again.
Okay.
I can just hold it for you.
Close.
I'll just hold it right there.
All right.
Think of it as like a giant lollipop. You can just.
All right. And for this sample, one thing that I'm gonna do is I'm gonna open up the Dev Console, because as soon as this connection dies, we're gonna see some problems. The thing is, like, okay, SignalR is gonna automatically try to reconnect. If you still have an app that's calling server.send hundreds of times a second, that's going to fail until the server starts back up, or until the network comes back up, or whatever caused you to lose connections besides. So at some point, though, you'll stop seeing those errors, and it will have reconnected eventually.
The flicker, that's
right.
Almost there.
But I'm just going to skip ahead and hook up the actual callback so you can see it. So the real problem that I'm trying to demonstrate with this demo is with automatic reconnects and easy API, but that doesn't stop you from thinking about what happens when you actually lose the connection. A lot of people might want to replay the messages that the client might have missed. If you're writing some sort of chat room, you probably don't want to miss chat messages if the connection was lost for 5 seconds. In the case of live video, you probably don't want to replay all the content.
Stefan, I'm going to keep nagging you because people say your mic doesn't work at all.
It doesn't work?
Maybe try just swap your mic
swap
with
mics.
Dan for now.
Dun, dun, dun. There's nothing could go wrong with this.
Yeah.
Da, da,
da, da, da. How's that?
All right, for the brave warriors out there, can you tell us if you can hear Stefan now?
Can you hear me now? I can hear myself now. I can hear echo. So
you
I'm thinking
louder.
It's a little better. All right. So what I was trying to continue with is just adding with automatic reconnect to your hub connection builder sequence will cause the client to automatically reconnect, but that doesn't stop you from thinking about what should happen once the client does reconnect. If I'm in chat room, I might actually want to query the database and get any messages that might have been sent to the room that I missed. In the case of something like video, it might be okay just to, you know, restart the video live, because replaying live video, to me, doesn't make that much sense. So with Reconnect, there's rarely a one-size-fits-all solution. So what we give you are events to do what you need to do. So about an hour before the stand-up, when I was trying to make this app work with automatic Reconnect, I did this myself. And rather than struggle and figure out how to make Reconnect work, we're going to look at the branches that I've already made. And we're going to check out my auto Reconnect branch and look at it. So sorry, guys. But we can look, because it isn't that many changes. So the biggest thing. All right.
You didn't stash yet.
That was the problem. Thank you. That's why. This is why I didn't want to actually write code. The git commands are hard enough. All right, now it succeeded. So basically, what we did is added the with auto reconnect that you saw, and then we're keeping track of the stream we were watching prior to the reconnect. So if we were to scroll down, when we start watching a stream, we record that stream name. And then also, if we were streaming when we started, or when we were reconnecting, in on reconnected, we added two new callbacks. On reconnecting, which stops streaming, which gets rid of all those errors that we saw if we were watching that, you know, F12 window with the counters going up into the hundreds. And then secondly, once we've reconnected, we'll restart the stream we were sending. And then if we were receiving any streams, we'll do that as well. This is a hack, because the other side, since we're stopping the server, all the clients are disconnecting at once. So the person trying to watch the stream might start watching before the reconnecting client sends the stream. I trust that you would be able to do something smarter, but that's why there's this while true until success. So
looks production ready.
Production ready. Yeah. You heard it from Dan Roth. We're going to run this sample again. And in about 5 to 10 seconds, we can get the updated code. So the only problem with the streamer example for Reconnect is the restart time on this is a little bit slow, but it's not too bad. And Safari will not remember that I want it to allow the camera usage. It might be because we're on localhost. So let's try it again. We're gonna stop the server. I'm gonna pull up.
And we were not doing this as part of the actual live community stand-up live stream. So this, that, you know, as much as we'd like it to be running on SignalR, that's not what happened. That was not.
We should.
Soon. We can save some bandwidth peer-to-peer, but I guess Google's paying for all the bandwidth, right? So I think we're okay. Either that or Amazon with Twitch. I don't know where everyone watches. All right. So here you'll see that we have the on reconnecting callback fired, and whoa, worked the first time. So we avoided the little race that while loop hopefully saved us there. So notice that I didn't refresh any of the browsers, and we're back to streaming live. So that's not the whole extent of the demo. There are two more things that I want to bring up. First is that by default, with automatic reconnect, we'll try reconnecting as soon as the connection is lost, after 2 seconds, 10 seconds, 30 seconds. I could be slightly off on the numbers. I highly recommend that you take a look at our docs. I'm sure you've seen this before. You can go to docs.microsoft.com, go to the ASP.NET Core docs, and if you select the version, we already have documentation for the preview. So you can see that I think I said that. That's 0 to 1,000 and 3,000 milliseconds. And if you pass that into automatic reconnect, you can change it. So if you want to keep trying even longer, you can, you know, keep on trying for every 30 seconds as long as you want. As soon as you hit the end of the array, if the reconnects have failed every single attempt, so this, right, 0 millisecond delay before the first reconnect, 2,000 millisecond delay before the second reconnect, 10,000 millisecond delay before the third. If it succeeds, right, then you're done. But this is only if there's failure. And if it fails every time, the closed event will fire. And at that point, you'll have to restart manually. Another thing to consider is that if start throws, so if you call connection.start and it throws an exception, we will not automatically reconnect in that case because you never connected in the first place. So for that initial start failure, you can imagine if someone had like configured their SignalR client wrong, that would be really annoying. If it, you know, retried for 30 seconds before, you know, you saw that you put in the wrong URL. So that's the reasoning behind that logic. Someone might just want to retry forever. So if you do that, passing in an array of delays before each retry isn't going to work. So the last API that's available to you is one that takes an interface. So here, if we go...
like your retry policy.
Yes, and that's exactly what it's called. So good job, Dan, on remembering that. And in this case, there's a single method to your iRetry policy. And you can just pass it into with automatic reconnect, just like the array. It's an overload. And that single method is next retry delay in milliseconds. Today, it takes two arguments, the number of previous retries and the number of milliseconds we've spent from the very beginning trying to reconnect so far since we first lost the connection. And this will use a random retry amount, a retry length. And the reason for doing that, by the way, is if the clients are reconnecting because the server has like crashed, having every client wait the same delay can cause you to DOS your own server. So this might be a reason why you would want a, you know, variable or random retry. And if you want to stop retrying, if you want the SignalR client to basically go to the closed state, you can return null. So the return value here is a number or null. And
it's interesting as you're showing this because just today, like having the YouTube stream drop and all that, having the website, like basically people have to know to refresh their browser. All this stuff is very applicable because a better version of the website would be checking and like restart automatically and all that, right?
So. Absolutely. And post 3.0, we've talked about some crazy ideas like seamless reconnect, I'm calling it, you know, copyright trademark. No, I'm sure someone's already copyrighted it. You know, we might even think about ways we can automatically replay some messages for you and, you know, for brief reconnect periods, you know, if it doesn't use too much memory. But we were very careful, at least on iteration one of automatic reconnect, not to do too much for you. Because if you're doing something like, you know, streaming live ASCII video, you might not want to waste all that memory when the client's gone for, you know, half a minute. So that, I think, concludes what I had to say about the automatic reconnect feature. The only thing I would add is that in Preview 6, the .NET client has the same API. It will be on docs.microsoft.com very soon. But it's a basic transliteration, I would say, of the TypeScript API. So if you, you know, liked what you saw in the TypeScript API, you're going to see something very familiar in .NET.
Cool.
All right. That's auto reconnection with SignalR.
Do you want the mic back?
We're going to keep it there. We're going to switch over to Sara. There we go.
All right, so I'm here to talk about some stuff that we already covered in a gRPC-specific show, but I thought I'll show again. So this is called out on the blog post. We have a couple of things that have landed in Preview 6. We got support for a managed gRPC client. We have you know, gRPC client factory, a la HTTP client factory support, and then we have support for gRPC interceptors. So let me go ahead and show a couple of things. So we've added support for a managed client. So folks in the .NET team did us a solid favor. They've added support for HTTP2 in HTTP client. So we're now able to use that and make gRPC calls using a completely managed client.
That reminds me, John, like folks should also go check out the .NET team's blog on all the stuff that's in Preview 6. Because in our blog post, we talk about the ASP.NET Core features, but .NET Core has all the .NET Core features, including like talking about the new HTTP2 support in HTTP client, which is pretty awesome.
Awesome. I will update the community links that I'm sharing to include that.
So one of the things that I was able to do, which is much easier using a managed client than the core client that gRPC shipped, was support for client certificates. Okay. So if you folks can see my screen over here, I have a sample where I'm reading a certificate from the store. And let's see. So yeah, I'm opening the My Store. I'm loading the cert that I've created. And in this example, I'm actually not sending the client cert with the sample. I've set up the server. Yeah, and if we jump over to Kestrel, Kestrel expects the client certificate. If I go ahead and try to run my gRPC client sample, let me go ahead and run this. You'll see that I have a error establishing the connection. At the time of the TLS handshake, my client never sent a client certificate, and the server rejected it with a 403, and hence my client, you know, blew up. I haven't written any fun code to handle it. So we can go ahead and change this. Let me go jump back into the client code. So there's nothing fancy here. I'm just, you know, newing up an HTTP client handler and adding a client certificate to it. This is the same way you'd use client certificates with HTTP client all along, and then using that to create my error client. So if I go ahead and run this sample now, we can see that since I have sent a client certificate, server actually accepts my request. So the sample I am showing you is a simple client streaming sample, so I can send it. It's the sample is an adder, so I can send a bunch of streamed messages, and then when I'm done and I send a new line, the server will reply with the sum. So this is something that made but required client certificates, which wasn't possible before. The other thing, if I jump back to our blog post, is we've added support for interceptors, right? And you might ask, what are interceptors? So I have this potentially scary diagram up here to talk about what interceptors are. So so when you have a request go through, your request goes through your client interceptor pipeline. So over here, you have access to the actual strongly typed message before it's serialized, before it's sent on the wire, right? And then your message goes through the delegating handler pipeline, which is the same pipeline that HTTP client uses. So the gRPC handler is just one of those handlers in that pipeline, and your entire interceptor pipeline runs. And then we have the same thing on the server side, where you have your middleware pipeline run, and we are integrated into endpoint routing in 3.0. So the gRPC handler is just your terminal endpoint that runs, and then your entire service interceptor pipeline runs. That gives you access to messages after they have been deserialized, and then you actually write your service implementation and goes back through the pipeline the same way. So you can think of interceptors as middleware, but gRPC specific middleware.
It looks like it mirrors the HTTP pipeline quite a bit in terms of the way it's architected.
Right, and not like both on the server and the client side. The delegating handler pipeline, that's something that HTTP client has always had.
Okay,
right?
That's the standard HTTP client pipeline.
And then the middleware pipeline is something that ASP.NET Core has always had. And there are a couple more things you can do with the interceptors that are
so
not...
You're saying this is the same API for both, right? So it's...
Yes.
Nice.
So there are a couple things which are harder to do with delegating handlers or middlewares, like especially when you do streaming requests. You can wrap the stream, so instead of only having the ability to act on every request or response, you can act on every message that's sent as part of the request or response. So I have an example up here where we implemented a request timeout interceptor. So the purpose of this middleware is it's for my client streaming request. If my client takes more than a certain amount of time, which let's see what I've set it up as. It's over here. So I've set a timeout of 10 seconds. That's what my interceptor takes. So if the client streams for more than 10 seconds, the server will terminate that one stream on the client.
So you wrote the timeout interceptor?
Well, one of our devs did.
Okay.
And so when you implement the interceptor, you would have to, implement a handler for all four request types, which are unary, client streaming, server streaming, and duplex streaming. In my case, I know the only service call I'm making is client streaming. So for the sake of brevity, I've only implemented one of these, but it's pretty straightforward and you can do the same thing. And the actual, if we look at the wire up cord in my server, at the time of adding my gRPC service to the pipeline, you can also configure all your interceptors. And when you add it this way, it's a scoped interceptor, and we have ways to add like global singleton interceptors. So it very much mimics what middlewares look like. So if I go ahead and run this now, so I think my, let me jump over to here. I think my server's already running. So I go ahead and run my client. So it's supposed to be, you can see that I've connected to the endpoint, and I should be unceremoniously disconnected if my client request takes more than 10 seconds. So, do any jokes till we reach 10 seconds? If you guys have something.
I have a question for you. What do you say when people ask, should I use gRPC or Signaler?
That's a fun
question. Oh, man. Hold on.
Yeah, I was throwing the curveball.
10 seconds. Answer it in 10 seconds.
10 seconds happened, so I have a good segue where you can see that my...
That was unrehearsed, by the way, obviously.
I'm in the middle. I don't want to get caught in anything. The Signaler guy and the gRPC guy.
Hey, I love all kinds of real-time messaging.
So while Stefan threw me off, we can see that... the server actually terminated the stream on the client, and this interceptor actually works, and it's not just vaporware. But to your point, Stefan, gRPC lends itself to for server-to-server communication. There are things like, obviously, client certs, enforcing policies through interceptors, like support for mutual TLS, things which are not necessarily the strengths of SignalR. Versus, they think SignalR does much better, especially when it comes to dealing with browser clients, having multiple transports, invoking methods on clients, having groups of clients. Those are all higher order framework features that gRPC doesn't have.
Yeah, I mean, browsers have HTTP though, right?
But browser APIs don't give you access to XHR2 or fetch. You can't really get HTTP2 framing from a browser.
Well, there you have it.
So. It's not an exhaustive answer, but there are, you know, and you can use both. You know, you can resolve a hub context from your gRPC service and party on both gRPC and SignalR, right?
I'm waiting for the next blog post in the community stand-up talking about just that.
That would make for a fun demo. We should do it next time.
Yeah.
All right, Dan, is the floor all yours?
All right, let's do it. Okay, I'm going to show some Blazor. Okay. So this is going to be a whirlwind tour of all the new Blazor features that we shipped in preview 6. Can people hear me all right? If I talk into this mic, does this work?
This one's louder.
This one sounds a lot louder. I'm going to give up on this mic. I'm taking your mic, Stefan. Taking your mic away from you. All right, here we go. So what we're going to do, let's go ahead and create a new ASMIC Core web application. And let's call this Blazor Preview 6 Demo. That looks good. And we're gonna create a Blazor server-side app, but notice that we can now go into the authentication options and enable authentication for our Blazor server-side application. We've turned on authentication. We've done a bunch of work in the framework to provide abstractions so you can get access to the current user, have components for pivoting content based on whether you have a current user or not. We've enabled all of the options. Like if you wanna do Azure AD or Azure DB to C or Windows Auth, you can do that. I'm gonna pick the option that's basically using ASP.NET Core Identity because that's what we ship and it's fun. So let's go ahead and create an AI.
That is pretty cool though, that all those features are available.
They're all available now. We haven't turned them the options on yet for the Blazor WebAssembly templates. We just haven't done the work. The abstractions are all there, though. We just need to do the template work to turn it on for the client-side Blazor templates. Okay, so we've got our application. I'm going to go ahead and run it so we can see what this app does. In the meantime, I'll show you a little bit of the code while it's getting up and running. So we're using the default identity UI for the login page and registration users. That's all just a Razor class library that we've included in the app. Here it's coming up already. I'll show you it in action. All right, so we get the app running. Now, up in the upper left-hand corner, you can see that we have some login and register links. Let's go ahead and register a new user. And this popped me over to that default identity UI. Like this is actually, now we're in like a Razor class library that's just added to the project. I can go ahead and add a new user. Let's add my favorite password, which is super secure and secret.
And then we'll register that new user. This will now require me to migrate the database because this is using Entity Framework Core under the covers to set up the identity schema. And boom, there we are. We're logged in to our application. Now we can click on that and we can get back to the identity UI and we can see all the normal stuff for like changing your password and doing confirming your email and so forth. So all the normal ASP.NET Core identity features are working here, but integrated with a server-side Blazor app. Okay, so now how does that work? Like, where does this UI come from? Let's go take a look at the code. If we look in our layout, in the main layout, you'll see that there is a login display component that's added to the layout. That's what's rendering those three links. Now, this is just a component that's in the template. It's not like a built-in thing. But if we go look at its implementation in this, you know, login display.razor file, we can see that that component is implemented using this authorize view component. This is a built-in component. This is new. This is a component that says, I will only render my content if the user is authorized and logged in. If there's a user, I'll render my content. And it's also a templated component. It has different templated parameters for rendering different things depending on the user's logged in state. So if the user's logged in and authorized, it'll render the, you know, hello and logout links. If the user's not logged in and not authorized, then you get the register and login link. So that's how that works. You can do even fancier things as well. Like if you want to set up a policy that says, you know, you're only really logged in if you match the likes donuts policy or whatever, you can do that. And that's using the standard ASP.NET Core authorization system for configuring policies and such. Also, if you like the old roles system, you want to put a role in here, that's fine. Like you want to say if you're an admin, then you can do that as well. Now,
quick question there. You said you mentioned like two-factor authentication stuff. Is authenticator required for that, or are you able to like extend or change two-factor auth?
The two-factor auth support is the normal two-factor auth support that just comes with ASP.NET Core Identity. So all the standard token flows that ASP.NET Core Identity supports is what's enabled here. We basically just took that pre-canned UI and wired it up in a server-side Blazor app. So authenticator apps, yes, they absolutely work. That's a pretty common scenario with using the 2FA.
Awesome. And then, like you said, the ability to extend or like it's the same patterns and everything if you need to get in and change any of that, right?
If you need to do a different 2FA, I don't know a lot about the 2FA extensibility in ASP.NET Core Identity, but we can take that as a offline follow-up and talk to Barry Dorans and folks that know more about security than I do. So the templates in this component, they get access to this context parameter. And this context parameter, you can see it's an authentication state object that's just contextual. It's flown in. We can take a look at it. All it has is the access to the claims principle for the current user. Now, where does this authentication state come from? Well, if we look at the root component for this app, which is in this app.razor file, this is where the router is being set up. And you'll see that in this template, the router is actually wrapped in this other built-in component, which is this cascading authentication state component. What that's doing is setting up the authentication state. It actually will look in the DI container to find a particular service that provides the current user. It then sets up the authentication state and then provides it as a cascading value throughout the component hierarchy. A cascading value is something that components can then opt into binding to so that they can get access to it, which is what that authorized view then does. This authorized view binds to that cascading value, which gives it access to this authentication state, which then it then uses to decide what to render. So that's the underlying infrastructure of how this is all working. This component basically gives you a way to render or not render a content based on whether the user is logged in. But if you want to do like a whole page, you can also do that. For example, if we go to our fetch data page and we want to say, you know, you can't see this page unless you're logged in and authorized. Well, we can do that. Well, how do you do that? Well, you use the normal authorize attribute that you would use in like SignalR or in MVC or in Razor pages. But with components, you don't typically have a code behind file. Like the class that's generated for the component is actually compiled from the .razor file. So we have a new Razor language feature. I'm gonna go ahead and add a using statement here real fast. So Microsoft, ASP.NET Core, authorization. And then we can use @attribute. @attribute says, please add this attribute to the generated class that gets compiled from this .razor file. And then here we can just go ahead and ask for this component. If we save this and go back to the app, now you'll notice that the app has, it's in this disconnected state. Like we've lost our connection to the server. What just happened there? Well, with server-side Blazor apps, remember the whole UI is being driven by a SignalR connection, which has been set up by, from the browser to the server to some state where all the components are running. And so every UI event goes to the server, the component runs, it figures out what it wants to render, and then that rendering lot, the rendered output then comes back down to the browser and it gets applied. Now, when we saved this Razor file, like I just changed some code, Visual Studio will now, once again, we had this feature for a while, we lost it for a little bit when we did the in-process hosting with IIS, which is that when you edit your code, Visual Studio will once again see that code has changed, kill IIS Express, restart it, rebuild your app, and get it up and running again, so you can have that edit, save, refresh workflow. So if I go back to the browser, I can just refresh, I don't have to rebuild, and everything is good. If I go to my fetch data page after I log out, let me log out first, let's go to fetch data, and we can see, oh, yeah, I'm not authorized, I can't see this particular page. So what's happening there is the router is detecting that there's an authorized attribute on that particular page, and it's preventing the content from being rendered. It's putting a little placeholder content instead. There is also infrastructure in place that if you want to like automatically redirect to the login page, you can do that. I think there may be some issues with that in preview 6, but we're getting that addressed in the next update in preview 7, which is just a few weeks away, honestly. So that's the other way that you can authorize some content is by just slapping on the normal authorize attribute onto your pages. So @attribute, that's a new feature. What other new Razor features do we have? Well, if you remember in Blazor, typically when you want to add some code to a component, you use this functions block. Let me can't type functions like this, and then you would type your code in here, like datetime dot let's say datetime date equals datetime dot now, right? And this is where you have like fields and methods that you're adding to the generated class. We've always felt that this functions name was a little awkward. Like it's not just functions, right? You're typing methods and maybe even inline classes and stuff like that. So we actually added a new alias for this Razor directive that's just code. So now our the recommended pattern for your Blazor components is that you put all your code in the code block. So this is a new Razor
question
feature.
On that. Is it just literally a new name? Is there any other difference other than it's called code instead of functions?
The semantics are exactly the same. There's no other difference. In fact, functions still work. So if you have functions blocks, don't worry. You can choose to still leave them. But for to make the experience better and more intuitive, we decided to add @code as a new Razor semantic. What else is new? Okay, let's look at attributes. So let me add a little bit of markup here. I'm going to add an input tag. Now, if I just hit space, you'll see that I'm now seeing all of these attributes that I can put onto this input that begin with the @ sign. And we call these now directive attributes. We have Razor directives, which are these keywords that begin with an @ sign in Razor. Now we have Razor directives. What are Razor directives? Well, Razor directives are attributes that can be applied to components and elements that impact compilation, like impact how the Razor file gets turned into C#. We've had a bunch of attributes for a long time in Blazor that do things like that, like bind and onClick, all the event handlers, ref. We added a new one in preview 6 called key, but they were all sort of organic in terms of their syntax. Like we just made up an attribute and added it on there. With directive attributes, we've standardized the syntax for what these things look like. They all now have this structure. So at the name of the directive attribute, and then you can have an optional suffix, and then an optional key, and then the value. All the directive attributes in Blazor now follow this standard syntax. So this is good for a couple reasons. It means, first of all, that when you're typing these things, you have a structure that you can learn and know. Like, not every attribute is different. They all follow this just general pattern. It's also good because it means that as we add new features to Blazor and to the compiler for turning components into C# code, we have a built-in structure that we can now use, a pattern that we can extend. And in the future, we hope to also make this a pattern that users can extend to add their own directive attributes. So just to show this in practice, like let's add bind. Like I want to bind this input to the date. It'll look like that, @bind, and then the value is going to be date. Similarly, if I want to change the format of how the date is bound, you notice if I add a colon, I can optionally add this sort of modifier, like a key value pair to the bind. I'm going to specify, in this case, the format. And the format I'm going to say is going to be year, 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 month, month, day, day, like that. And then just to show that that's working, let's go ahead and render out also the date as a separate value. So we can, should be able to save that. Yep, looking good. Let's refresh the browser. Because it's, you know, edit, save, refresh flow again. It's really nice. Let's go to the home page. Okay, so now we see our input, and we can see the rendered value below. The rendered value is just basically the two string of the date. But the input is using that format. It's using the year, month, date format. If I change things, you can see that the date time value got changed by the bind, and it actually rendered the correct value. We can even switch the year to like pretend it's 1999. And there we go. So you can see that the value is actually updating. So that's directive attributes. You know, and things that we want to do in the future, what this enables is, like, for example, let's say we want to prevent default, like prevent the default action of an event that's happening in the browser. We don't have a convenient way to do that today in Blazor. We want to add it, and now we have a pattern that we can use. Like, you could just say, like, bind, you know, but, you know, trigger the event, but prevent default. This is not an attribute that exists today, but in the future, we hope to be able to add it, if that makes sense. Or similarly, like, you know, maybe we would do on click, colon, stop propagation for, like, stopping the propagation of the event up the DOM. These are features that we expect to add in the future, and directive attributes gives us a way to do that.
You know what the current bind event that the internal telesense is showing you does?
The current bind event? The which one?
I'm not super familiar with Blazor. Bind, colon, event.
Oh, what does bind do?
Colon, event. Like, what's the colon event?
Oh, okay. So there's another one in here, right? It was bind, colon, event. What is this doing? So by default, bind will, depending on the element, will bind to a particular attribute and event. Like, bind is basically a shorthand for saying, take this C# value. When the component renders, render it onto this element using this particular attribute. Like, in the case of an input, it'll be the value attribute. And then it will also wire up a particular event, like in the case of input, it'll be the onChange event. And it will say, when the onChange event occurs, then set the C# value to that new value and then re-render the component.
I see. It's the two-way part of the binding.
So if I want to do, like, onKeyPressed in here, you can say that I want to bind to the C# land value whenever onKeyPressed is... That's probably completely the wrong event name. I don't even know what the event name is, but you get the idea.
No, thank you.
Okay, a few questions if I can jump in.
Yeah, go ahead.
So can you show the code behind the attribute syntax?
Yeah. So let's go and show all files, and we'll go into our OBJ folder, debug, Rio, Razor, pages, and I think I added it to fetch data, right? So in the fetch, I mean, this is hideous generated code, right? It's really hard to read. But if we scroll down just a little bit, we should see a class. Okay, we found the class. And then up above, see, there's the authorized attribute that's just being added to the class. The indentation is completely wrong, and that looks really weird. But fundamentally, what's happening is when I say at attribute, it's just taking that attribute, a normal CLR attribute, and adding it to the class that's being generated. That's
cool.
What it does. Yeah.
All right. A few other questions, if you don't mind here.
Yeah.
So for the attribute annotation, is that pretty similar to just putting an attribute on a class?
The at attribute which
yeah, this is going backwards.
Yeah. So yes, it is exactly the same. Like, when I do at attribute, it is literally putting the attribute that you specify onto the generated class. That's what we were just looking at in the generated code.
Okay, two more questions and then I'll let you jump back in. Will Blazor provide a mechanism to persist and restore component state for disconnected clients instead of keeping it in memory until it expires or the client reconnects?
That's a great question. So this I'm disconnected state UI has is a source of some concern, because, like, this will happen anytime, like, the server restarts, like, and you click this retry button, you're like, it's not working, it's not doing anything, what's happening there? Well, this UI is intended to represent two things. One is, if the connection gets lost to the server, then you see this UI. And then once, if the server comes back up and you're able to then connect to it over the network, but the state that you were originally connected to is gone, which typically happens after a server reboot, then you still won't be able to reconnect, because the state for this particular user's session is no longer available to be had. And this retry button, all it's trying to do is just trying to reconnect back to that state, but it's not there, and so it doesn't do anything in this case. You actually need to hit F5 to refresh the browser to establish new state on the server. And that's a problem. You obviously don't want your users, if they're like in the middle of like ordering their pizza and they put all their toppings and they have it perfect and they're just about to click order, and then someone pushes a patch to the server and restarts the server, and then y'all, the users, a user session gets reset, and they see that ugly UI. By the way, you can customize that UI to do other things, and we do plan to make some improvements to it. So the way to solve that is you need to have some way to persist the state on the server and rehydrate it again, so that when the server comes back up, the user's browser can actually reconnect back to the original state. Now, we are going to provide the extensibility hooks in the framework so that you can persist and you can rehydrate. We will provide documentation and guidance for how you should do that. Those are things that we are actually working on right now. There, if you're curious to go dig around a little bit on the infrastructure that's there, I believe the type is the circuit factory is the thing that handles like creation of circuits. And that's probably where I would start looking to if you want to try and plug in. But it's an area of current investment to make it so that you can deploy Blazor apps into production and have a good experience around state persistence.
So like trying to put myself in the customer's shoes for a second, I think part of the problem is if I don't override it and I restart my server, retry just does nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So I like that you can override it, but like being able to refresh, like even if it did reset all your state.
So like, there's a couple like
giving a warning.
Some of the improvements we plan to do to that UI, like one thing is we might add some logic that actually detects like, okay, I'm able to connect back to the server, but my state is no longer there. No point in keep on trying. I'm just gonna actually refresh the browser for the user and say, sorry, you know, server crashed or whatever, server went down, we have to restart. We'll also probably de-emphasize the retry button if it's not applicable, and probably give text that says if you may need to actually refresh the browser. We plan to do some usability improvements to clarify that the end user experience. But ideally, okay. You don't want to have that at all, right? Like if you see that UI, it's kind of as if the server crashed, and so you want to avoid people ever seeing that UI, and that's why dealing with the persistence problem is going to be important, and we're working on guidance that we can give you on how to handle that.
Okay, one more question here on Blazor. Question, what about client-side Blazor but server-side pre-render?
Client-side Blazor, server-side pre-render. Yes, you can absolutely do that. I didn't have that as part of this demo flow, but I'll point you to a sample app actually that I put together, which is now updated. No, that's on my account.
I heard that the stream died. I opened Outlook, so I just got an email.
Oh, no.
That was from a while
ago. Is this from earlier? Okay. I think this is from earlier. Yeah,
are you still
good.
There, people? Are you still there?
Heart attack.
This is what I get for opening Outlook during the stream. My bad.
Client-side Blazor with pre-rendering. This is we can put this link in the links that John sends out as well. This is a sample that shows how you can wire up pre-rendering of your client-side Blazor apps using the same mechanism that we use in server-side Blazor. What this enables is the pixels from the client-side Blazor app get pre-rendered on the server. They get sent down to the browser really fast, and then while the WebAssembly runtime is being downloaded in the background, it then fires it up as soon as it's downloaded and then sets up the app for interactivity. This is something you can do today, and go check out this sample if you're interested in doing that.
Okay, two more questions.
Okay.
They're flying in now. Jim asks, for attribute naming, can we have prefixes for our library?
For attribute naming, can you have prefixes? I assume for attribute naming, they're talking about like if I want to do my own directive attributes. Like,
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the core syntax is what you saw. There's no like built-in prefix notion. We might need to establish some sort of like convention or something that when you bring in, if libraries bring in an extensible set of directive attributes, like how they can avoid collisions. It's an interesting problem. For 3.0, we don't plan to actually open up extensibility for directive attributes in that time frame. We're just basically trying to lay the right foundations so that when we are ready to do that we have the right underlying pieces in place. But don't expect directive attribute extensibility anytime soon. We're just trying to lay the groundwork.
Okay. So I guess that relates to the next one. There's a for attribute syntax, is there a canned example of rolling one's own name with a suffix or a key, and it sounds like that's pretty similar.
You can look at the ones that we've implemented for Blazor ourselves and see how we've done that, but it's not something that's an open extensibility point yet. We're just trying to explain why do we do this? Like we changed the syntax in preview 6 and people are like, you broke my app, like why? And the reason is because we're trying to set Blazor up for future extensibility.
Cool. Okay, and then one last one is, are we getting official Blazor SignalR client?
Official Blazor SignalR client. Eventually. Yeah. Eventually.
I mean, Blazor does have some unique requirements when it comes to SignalR. Not for 3.0, that I think for 3.0, you're going to use the regular SignalR client. So if you're on the server, that means like .NET client or something.
So what you can do today is there are, I believe there are two options. One is you can take the SignalR JavaScript client and you can shrink wrap it with JavaScript interop code and call into it as if it were C#. There are community projects that already have set that up for you today that you can just go grab their NuGet package, download it, and install it. There is also the possibility of using the .NET SignalR client inside a Blazor app. I mean, Blazor is running .NET code. The main issue you hit if you just try it as is that under the covers, the .NET client will try to call into WebSocket APIs, which are not yet enabled in Blazor. The Mono folks have actually done the work in the runtime, but we haven't done the work in Blazor yet to enable all of the Mono bindings so that we can just call into the normal system.whatever.websocket call. There is someone who took the .NET SignalR client and ripped out the underlying transport layer and plumbed in some JavaScript interop code to talk to the browser WebSocket APIs. That is a second option that you can use for using SignalR in client-side Blazor today.
Yeah, and just to add, the reason you might want to proxy your server-side Blazor SignalR like RPC calls through your browser is one for like things like cookies and so forth might get proxied better that way. Another consideration is if you have a bunch of different clients connecting to the same server, they might already have that connection. And having a bunch of client machines connect to a single server tends to not run into issues like port exhaustion, as opposed to having your server make all those connections on the client's behalf.
I think you're talking about in the case where you try to use SignalR in your component code in a server-side Blazor application.
Yes. So using SignalR in your Blazor application.
So normally, like in client-side Blazor, like the SignalR pattern would be the same as if you're writing an Angular app or a React app. If you're writing a server-side Blazor app where your components literally are already on the server, for a bunch of cases, you can leverage the existing SignalR connection for getting a real-time feel for things already. Like if you have like a background process that you want to use to update the UI, you can just have the component state get updated by that background process and then say, state has changed, the component will re-render, and then the UI and the client will go ahead and re-render. So some of the, like, I want to just, you know, push some UI updates from the server to the client are actually very straightforward in server-side Blazor without writing any SignalR code at all. But there are still cases where you might want to write explicit SignalR code yourself.
In which like case to a third-party server, for example.
There are
that would
that you'd have
be
to
an example.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Yeah. So great. Any more questions? Was that? Did I get them all?
One last question.
One more.
Has the Mono WASM assembly shrunk anymore?
The Mono WASM assembly did shrink in preview 6, which was great. Thank you, Mono folks, for all the hard work they did to do that. And then we pulled in some additional dependencies in the Blazor side and brought it right back up to where it was. So one of the things we did in preview 6 is we switched from using this sort of one-off. We had a specialized JSON serialization stack in Blazor that we were using. It was simple JSON, which was a derivative of, I believe it was originally from Facebook. And we switched over to using system text JSON in preview 6, which is the new serializer that's coming from our friends on the .NET core team. That unfortunately did pull in, and I think there were some other changes maybe in the auth world that pulled in some additional dependencies that bloated the app size up a bit. Now, one thing that we need to do that we haven't done yet is we only run the linker, the IL linker, on the like BCL types that come from our friends on the Mono team. We don't actually run the linker on anything else, like none of the Blazor assemblies or anything like that. There is a good chance that once we, if we start playing around a little bit with our linker config, that we'll be able to link out a bunch of the stuff that got pulled down in preview 6. If anyone wants to play around with that and beat us to that investigation, that would be great. Right now, we are pretty heavily focused on getting server-side Blazor ready to ship. So you may notice that client-side Blazor is kind of slowing down a little bit in terms of its pace of development. We are keeping it up to date with each .NET Core 3.0 release, but not as much, you know, client-side specific work is happening right now, just because we want to make sure that server-side Blazor is really ready for those production scenarios when we ship later in September.
Okay. Can you switch back to the cam if you're done showing your desktop, or?
Oh, I had one more.
Okay, let's see it.
Yeah, we did all those questions just like while everyone's just staring at my Visual Studio.
Yeah, they're winging them at you. It's like white stump Dan Ross.
All right, let me show a couple more things. I got like 2 minutes. Let's see. So, namespace.
Turn on picture in picture.
What's that?
There should be a picture in picture thing. PIP.
Yeah, turn it off.
Trust it.
No, turn it on. Teams. So we see in the. People want to see you.
No, I'm kidding.
All right, I guess nothing happened.
Nothing happened. I don't know if I did anything. Anyway, I'm going to keep going. So
okay, go.
Let's say you want to change the namespace of a component. Like, so this counter component, I can add a counter component to my app here. And you'll see that there's two syntaxes, right? You can add it by name because I have a using statement in place, or you can do the full name of the type, right? And the namespace for my counter is blazer-preview6demo.pages. What if I want to change that? So let's go ahead and add the full long version counter. Yeah, let's do this one. So that adds a counter. Now if I go back to my counter component, I can add the at namespace directive up here and switch the namespace to something else, like my namespace. Save that. If we go back to index now, we should see that, hopefully soon. There it goes. Yeah, so now it's no longer purple. The purple is gone. That means this type isn't being recognized anymore. Why is that? Well, if we look at doing a counter now, you can see the namespace of the counter is now my namespace.counter. So you can control the namespace of your components. This is important, of course, because for components to be in scope, you need to have the namespace in scope. And so if you want to have all your components be in the same namespace, this is a convenient way that you can now do that with a Razor directive. I think I'm going to stop there. That was the last one. The other demo I'm just going to talk briefly to is publishing your app, your server-side Blazor app to Azure. There's some really nice tooling now in Visual Studio where it will help you add the Azure SignalR service to your server-side Blazor app. That'll be really important when you want to scale, get WebSockets going and scale out to lots and lots of client connections. The Azure SignalR service is really important for doing that and works great with server-side Blazor. So when you go to publish your server-side Blazor app, the Visual Studio will say, hey, we recommend using the Azure SignalR service. You can just add it as a dependency. It'll add a single package to your app. You don't have to change a line of code, and you're ready to publish. You publish your app, and it just works. You should give it a try. Check it out. And that's all right. What I've got.
Well, we're at about time, and I think one of you needed to get going at 5 anyways, right?
I do. I have. Otherwise, I drive a van. And I have a bunch of people that won't be able to get home unless I go and drive.
Oh, them. Dear.
In my spare time, I'm a bus driver.
Wow. Well, this was great. Thank you for rolling with it, answering all the questions, and being there, like restarting the stream when we needed to do that.
Thanks, everyone, for hanging with us. I'm sorry about the technical issues we had. We will get better. Yeah. Auto reconnections and stuff. I'm sure we'll have a part to play in that.
Yeah, no one heard that. Yeah. I wasn't born in '73.
All right. Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, that's it for this week. So we have the links. I've been updating them as we've been going. They're going to be in the show description, and we've chatted them out, and they're on the Twitters and everything. So awesome. And congrats on shipping Preview 6, and Woo! Looking forward to – well, so what's next? Are we looking at Preview 7, or is this – what happened?
Preview 7 will come out it's about once a month. So, think mid-July-ish is when you should expect Preview 7 to be available.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks, everyone.
Yep.
Bye. See you.
Bye.